is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good evening. Everyone can hear me? Good, thank you. Nice to be here with you tonight. As some of you know, I've written a book about my Zen life, and it's this book. Can you see that? It's called Autumn Light, My 50 Years in Zen. And Autumn Light is part of my Dharma name, which is Shuko Zaku. This evening, I'm going to read parts of the book that I hope will be interesting to you. But I want to tell you that I'm also thinking of doing a 4-meeting study group, possibly later this year or in the new year. To start off this evening, we're no longer to meet in our Dharma hall. So I thought I would read a little bit from the introduction about the Dharma hall for people who would be reading the book, just to give us some nostalgia for where we have come from and hope for where we go next. Red Cedar Zen Community Zendo in Bellingham, Washington is softly lit and unadorned. A small wooden altar at the front holds a gray stone Buddha, a glass vase of fresh flowers, an incense bowl, and a large flickering candle. On the bamboo floor, neat rows of square black mats with round black cushions placed on top announce that this is a place of order, serenity, and safety. The soothing light and silence invite us to be gentle with ourselves and each other. Entering, we select a place to sit and do a small standing bow to it before sitting down alongside with 25 other Zen students. A roughly equal number of men and women attend on Wednesday evenings, Red Cedar's primary weekly meeting time. Our ages range from early 20s into the 80s. Get my reading glasses on so I can read this small print. The first 3 chapters of the book describe some challenges I faced as a teenager and later in my early adulthood. I will skip those because that's something that isn't directly pertinent to what our practice is right now, but you might be curious about that and want to buy the book. So that's my little holding it out in front of you. So I came to Zen in my late 30s after some difficulties in my life. And I started to learn, as many people do, to sit Zazen by reading a book about it. So I read a little couple of paragraphs about that period. 3 weeks into my tentative home practice, I was convinced I was not doing Zazen correctly. I was so easily distracted by daily concerns, and my knees hurt sitting cross-legged. I needed instruction. That week, I read in the local newspaper about a community college class on Zen Buddhism to be taught by a Japanese Zen priest. Excited by the synchronicity of my need and this opportunity, I signed up for the course. I looked forward to this new experience, but I was anxious about venturing so far outside my conventional WASP upbringing. Since college, I had leaned toward the disconsolate existential view of life as intrinsically meaningless. I had tamped down incipient longings for inspiration. Now, in the early 1970s, desperate to improve an abusive home situation, I was willing to risk joining an exotic course on Zen. The first evening, 80 people showed up for the class, far more than the number of chairs in the room. I was surprised and reassured by this level of interest. Perhaps this wasn't such an odd thing to be doing. Sitting mostly on the classroom floor, we students eagerly awaited the teacher. Finally, several minutes late, a slender young Japanese man with a shaved head swept into the room. He wore elegant flowing black robes, A crisp white shawl collar accented his shining face. I was transfixed. This was Kobenchino Sensei, just a few years in the United States and newly in charge of the Zen community, Haiku Zendo, in Los Altos, California. He would become my teacher, fulfilling the adage, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. His English wasn't so good, but even though I could understand only a part of what he said, I found him magical. The next few chapters in the book expand, describe my expanding practice, living in Japan for a year and practicing at a Rinzai monastery, returning to the United States and practicing with Rev Anderson at Green Gulch in California. And through these experiences, I gradually gained some confidence in my practice. In 2003, I moved to Bellingham and became a member of Red Cedar, where I got involved in supporting our slowly growing Sangha. Over time, I took on responsibilities. I was invited to be Shuso, or head student, in 2010 or 11, I can't remember which. And then in 2013, I ordained as a priest. One of the requirements of which was to do a 3-month practice period at Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery in California. This was a big step for me. I was 78 years old, and I knew the practice period at Tassajara was going to be very strenuous, and I resisted for several weeks agreeing to do it, but in the end, I did. I thought it was the only way I could ordain, so I did. The bulk of the book is about my Tassajara experience, how challenging it was, and the important things I learned from it. First, I'll read a little about Tongariro, the continuous 5 days of Zazen required of students doing their first practice period at Tassajara. We were called the Tongariro students from then on. The first day was taken up with learning what to do all day. The first day of Tongariro, that is. There were 19 Tongariro students, and after that first day, various experiences occurred. I'll read briefly from mine. After settling in on first day, second day, my mind and body went in and out of sensation, discomfort, misery, and delight. Toward late afternoon, I began to have spontaneous visual hallucinations that rose on the wall. I faced, just to face, 2 feet in front of me. The wall was white adobe, supported every 3 or 4 feet by vertical 5-inch wide, reddish-brown studs of coarsely grained wood. As I gazed softly at the wall, the wood grains lines began to waver and flow in various beautiful patterns. I had experienced such visual distortions termed makyo during sessions before, and I knew they were not indicative of any spiritual attainment. However, each time these makyo bloomed, as it were, I enjoyed their arising and falling before I shook myself mentally back to viewing the simple wall. Though uninvited, makyo helped pass the long Tongariro hours. On the final 2 days of Tongariro, I also hallucinated handwriting on the wall. It was much like a handwritten letter in which the lines tilt up as they go down the page. I couldn't read what the writing said, but I appreciated the irony of the message. The handwriting was indeed on the wall. The first month or two, we monks spent learning how to follow the schedule in all the forms that were required for daily life, practice roles, and ceremonies. Make a page here. Intensive training for all of us. Most of us new monks struggled the entire first month to learn the specifics of each day's schedule and to carry them out correctly. The biggest challenge for everyone may have been a subtle one. Our schedule replicated the Japanese monastic tradition of giving the monks a partial day off on days having the numbers 5 and 9 in their dates. This created a 5-day weekly rotation of 4 days of community activity and 1 partial day off for personal time. after a lifetime of 7 day weeks, 5 days may have been unconsciously disorienting. Eventually, we lost track of what conventional weekday it was, except for needing to contact someone in the outside world, which I rarely did. Knowing which calendar day it was became irrelevant. We monks learned to communicate with each other about time solely in terms of which kind of day it was, regular, work, personal, or sesshin. Once my brain fully adapted to this cycle, my daily dizziness subsided. On top of this subtle adjustment in our biorhythms, we often had to adjust to smaller schedule variations. Sometimes the leadership added or subtracted a regular day in order to schedule the correct number of sesshin days, or at the last minute they changed a Dharma talk or ceremony, which would have occurred in the Zendo, to a presentation in the dining room. These changes usually were not announced except on the monk's assignment chart outside the Zendo. I was not on a regular work crew, such as for meal serving, so I was not even aware of this communications mechanism until the third month of practice period. This explained my repeated surprise and annoyance at the frequent unannounced schedule changes. On paper, these adjustments seemed like very minor perturbations, simple enough to absorb. However, until I was well broken in on the schedule, I experienced them almost as body blows. No doubt old age played a role in this strong reaction. Five weeks into practice period, we had our first sesshin. Nope, I want to go back. I've skipped a page here, 76. Right from the start, like the second week that we were in practice period, the abbess, who was the head of practice for the practice period, began teaching us. And the other classes were taught by the Tanto, head of practice, and the Tassajara administrator. And we had a lay entrusted abiding teacher who also taught. All of whom were very fully all authorized as teachers and very good ones. The abbess set the initial theme of paying attention to our minds and bodies. First, the abbess spoke of our personal practice bodies, quote unquote. The schedule, she said, allows us to get to know the body of your practice, the habit body or karma body, the one you usually have. This contains ideas about ourself, our life story, built on what is already familiar. When things are not working, such as at the beginning of practice period, when we are trying to follow a new and demanding schedule, she said, we are not capable of identifying what will work for us. We keep bumping into our karma body, which has been shaped by past karma, which also creates karma going forward. The schedule forces us to meet our habitual patterns as we try to manipulate circumstances to suit what we've been and done in the past. But because we cannot manipulate the monastery schedule, we feel unable to cope with this new situation. I thought she had a wonderful insight and really reassured me that I was in good hands. She knew what was going on for us. We were all in shock, trying to fit into this very rigid and demanding schedule. So she said that, and then she said, or with a twinkle in her eye, we can use the new schedule to liberate ourselves from our habitual karma. Thus the abbess began to point the way to get through the hardships of the initial weeks of practice period. And indeed it did liberate most of us from our old ways. And the administrator encouraged us in how to get through the long days of sitting and how to deal with the afflictive states of mind. The administrator was the kind of business leader of the practice period. She was a different person from the abbess who headed it. And she, both all of these people were very good teachers, fully authorized to do that. So the first month, every day, we interacted with people we had just met. Naturally, we used whatever socialization modes and skills we had developed in the past, perhaps long years past. We brought different expectations and behavioral habits to our relationships with different categories of people whom we developed friendship with different categories of people. The leaders, work teammates, dorm mates, and a handful of monks with whom we developed friendships in the little free time we had. I brought certain advantages to this situation. I had professional experience studying group dynamics, leadership, and communication problems in groups. I had attended many residential Zen sessions over the years. I knew how to share sleeping quarters and work tasks with strangers. I also brought two disadvantages. I was decades older than the other monks, and I had lived alone for the previous 30 years. I might be less aware and practiced in interpreting and flexing with other people's behaviors. Silent interactions with other community members provided many opportunities to observe my habitual assumptions about myself in relation to others. I shouldn't have been surprised that my habitual karma body reactions weren't always effective. I discovered that my strategy for integrating into a new group was to insist on being helpful, quote unquote. I hadn't been aware of this habit before. I became aware of it now only because it didn't work well. If it had worked, I might never have seen it. In our silence, perhaps my intended helpfulness was not evident to others. Being helpful may depend more on language than on one's actions. Whatever the case, when I saw what I was doing or attempting to do, I was startled. Was I trying to manipulate people into accepting me? If so, I might be interfering with them, something I did not want to do. I was excited to realize I could discard this habit. Of course, I would help when asked, but I would no longer expect that helping would bring me acceptance. Quite an insight for me. Chapter 11 of 16 chapters is titled The Mirror Cracks. So you can begin to suspect that things are going to start to fall apart, which they did in an interesting way. In the final evening of our first sesshin, we monks participated in a Shosan ceremony. In this ritual, the sesshin teacher sits in front of the altar. Each student goes to her, bows, and before the assembled students, asks a sincere question about his or her practice. All the monks asked interesting questions, and the abbess's answers were insightful. When it was my turn, I asked, "How can I face my fears?" So she said, "Set your intention every morning to get acquainted with your fear, and every evening to evaluate your experience. Not to judge how well you have done, but to track your efforts in meeting and exploring fears." I thought this a gentle and yet practical answer to ponder as later I lay down asleep to sleep that night. That night I had a powerful dream. In it, I opened the door to leave my small Tassajara dorm room. As I stepped over the threshold in the dream, an enormous leopard burst out from under an adjacent closed door, which in the dream I recognized as the door to my basement in my childhood home. The leopard lunged at me, snarling and clawing ferociously. Terrified, I leapt backward into my room and slammed the door, shutting the leopard out. I woke up, gasping for air. I had asked the abbess what to do about fear, and in my dream, fear jumped right out at me. The leopard dream was very startling and stayed with me a long time. After I returned from Tassajara, it eventually became the organizing symbol of what I had learned from my monastic experience and from writing about it. The story gets more personal now. In the next chapters, I describe troubling conflicts I had with two different fellow monks and what I learned from them. This was a common feature of monastic life, a practice period, is that you end up having a conflict with somebody, at least one person, and it's very instructive for understanding yourself during at least the practice period and also after that. So it's a a really coveted experience. If you didn't have one of those, you might have missed something really rich. So I've looked at it. Of course, it was always difficult in the moment to deal with it. So here the mirror cracks. The story gets more personal, and now read one more section here. This chapter is ropes end, so things are getting even worse. In November, we entered the final month of practice period. The days were still warm, 80 degrees by noon, but freezing, near freezing at 4 a.m. when we got up. I had the monastery routine down well enough to believe that if I just kept trying, I could make it to the end. We had two more 7-day sessions to sit. The momentum toward ever deepening, deeper practice was building. The expectation was that all of us monks would attempt to break through our conditioning. Head down, I would go forward. My body mind had another plan. 2 months of sleep deprivation seemed to be as long as I could hang on to the rope of my determination. But the mind now flipped chaotically in all directions, from determination to resentment, anxiety to anger, resignation to hope, blame to gratitude, appreciation to despair. I couldn't modulate the intensity of my thoughts and feelings, let alone direct them. They sank and soared on their own. Repeatedly, when I vowed to get more sleep, I continued to sit zazen every evening. Repeatedly, when I resented someone's behavior and applied the antidote, don't know, I soon fell back into blaming. The cognitive brain was no longer in charge. The mind was running its own crazy relay race, but it repeatedly dropping the baton. Sometimes I slept well at night, but the next day was so exhausted I could barely move. Other times I slept poorly, but felt energetic next morning. When I was not tossed around by the gusts of emotions, I seemed to drift mentally, increasingly missing connections between events. Was I finally living in the moment, or was I unraveling? Save the Body, as a chapter title, describes how I reached my limit physically and emotionally. For the entire practice period, I had taken very good care of myself physically. I got as much sleep as was allowed, which was about 6 hours a night. I did yoga every day, swam in the pool. They had to actually have a pool at Thos Har, which is wonderful, on personal days, which happened every 5 days. I ate well, the food was very well cooked and presented, and still I wore completely out. The final two chapters in the book are about coming home and recovering and what I learned from this very big experience and by writing about it. So that's a short trip through my book, Autumn Light. Anybody have questions?
I do.
Okay.
What would you say you carry now from your experience at Thos Har? In other words, how does it affect you today that you spent that time there? Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And it had a big impact on me, actually. Not one that I knew as I left Thos Har, but as what I learned by reflecting on it in order to write about it. And I came to see that some of my early conditioning as a child and younger person kept me from having confidence in myself and being and speaking up for who I was or who I am. And I was able to let go of that early conditioning from having confronted it. Not actually realizing it at the time, but trying to understand what had happened to me and why it had been so difficult. So it had a huge effect on me. Mm-hmm. I feel quite free emotionally. My phone is ringing, of course, but just a moment. Sorry. Okay. Does that answer what your question
yeah.
was? Okay.
Yeah, that does. Thank you. Question.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to have the room next to Edie's in the dorm. And I really so appreciated Edie being there. It was really growing closer together during those 3 months for myself. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Elizabeth McDonald was also there. So we three of us knew at least two other people, which was very comforting, even though we hardly spoke during the time because the schedule was so intense that we were in silence all the time.
Edie, did you reach a point in your at Tassajara that you thought, I cannot go any further, I'm done? And what was the energy that took you beyond that point?
It was, I think, accepting that that was as far as I could go. I've always felt compelled to try harder. I mean, that's kind of a big message in Zen. Keep trying, try harder, try harder, try harder. And it was definitely an explicit message at Tassajara. Come to evening Zazen, whether you're dead or not, you know, be there. And it's a strong, effortful practice, monastic Zen. And I was thoroughly indoctrinated in that because I've been doing it for many, many years. I appreciated the benefits of it. But it also has flaws when you're kind of old and crickety, you know. So I did reach that point, though, when I realized I just couldn't do more. And I probably had never reached that point in my life. That it's not that I've always done so much, but I never believed that I could stop for my own health and benefit. So that was liberating for me very deeply.
So did you reach into a little extra energy or faith in yourself or?
Not at the time, but after I was home and recovered, I could see that that's what had happened. I'd come to the fact that I didn't have to do more than what I could do.
Okay.
And I really recommend that experience to everyone, to realize that you don't have to do more. You don't have to be somebody else. You know, you have to be yourself fully.
Well, thank you for the book. Thank you for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you. Okay.
Hi, Edie. I've been trying to get through, but I guess I don't know how to unmute.
Oh, you're
but
here.
I really appreciate your explaining that even after so many decades of practicing, you have to go back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that so much because I keep going back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think I've been so hard-headed all my life that it took it had to be knocked out practically to get to loosen up and to get in touch with that deep conditioning. Not everyone has to do that because I've gone through many sesshins and 3 week periods, and I was 6 weeks in a monastery in Japan, and you'd think, you know, that would have knocked it out of me, but it hadn't. It took old age and a real supreme effort on my part to get there. So if you want to go there, maybe you don't have to go that route, but
I think it takes that much for most of us. It takes a whole lifetime.
Yeah, definitely. So I came away feeling a lot of joy in my life. Can't beat that.
Edie, I had a question.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you saw or knew of any monks who were disabled It sounds like what you went through was very physically intensive. So mm-hmm. if there were differing abilities,
mm-hmm. for you work. Not too many. I myself am kind of disabled because I have a very bad back. So it's physically difficult for me, but I certainly was able to do it physically. Don't remember, Chris, did we have anyone who needed to have like wheelchair? I don't think so. And I don't think you could do it.
Tassajara is not wheelchair accessible. I mean, theoretically it is, but you couldn't do it.
Yeah, in certain centers you can. You know, in urban centers, there's accommodation for people. Mm-hmm. Like this endo that we had a bit of accommodation to get in the front door and so forth. Though we had two stories, so you couldn't, if you had a wheelchair, you couldn't go down the stairs and that kind of thing. But no, the monastic life is perfect for 30-year-old people mm-hmm. who have all their faculties. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's a tradition. In Japan, it's young people who are in monastic life. Anything else occur?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Edie.
Yeah.
Thanks, Edie. I just want to appreciate just your story. Just hearing it, it's inspiring that at that age you would go and take all that on and have it be a whole new chapter of life.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it was my long habit of obedience that drove me there. I let go of some of that through the experience. So not nearly as obedient as I was before I went. So, my superiors would not like that perhaps, but I enjoy it. Shall we close?
Yeah.
Okay. May our
intentions
equally expand to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.